Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's another episode of Simply Amazing. Tim Ryder from The Apple. Got a very fun show lined up today. Taryn's back. He's going to be with us shortly. We also have our buddy Andy Billman. Andy worked for ESPN for many years. He's got a new documentary coming out. It's called War on the Diamond. It's the story of Ray Chapman, who, if you're not familiar, was the only major leaguer to be killed on the playing field in major league history. That happened in 1920. Takes you through his story, takes you through the story of Cleveland baseball, their rivalry with the Yankees, who at the time, you know, this is a very heated rivalry with New York at the time, and the pitcher who killed Chapman, Carl Mays, was a pitcher with the Yankees, and it's a really multi-layered little journey that Andy and his pals take us through, but we're going to get into that. We're going to get into everything that's going on with the Mets so far, from Jake DeGrom and those wild rumors, qualifying offers being thrown around or not thrown around in some cases, Cookie's back. We're going to be talking about kind of where things line up as this offseason kind of jumps off. But yeah, we'll have Taryn with us shortly. Andy's going to be coming on with us in a second, so you guys hang out. Hey, everybody. We are back. As discussed, we have a special guest today. This is not very Mets related, but you guys are going to get a kick out of this. I recently had the opportunity to check out a pre-screening of War on the Diamond, which is a really, really cool film, documentary style, but it also tells the story of Ray Chapman, who some of you might be familiar with, some might not. He was a player in the teens, was the only major leaguer to die on the field of play, was hit by a pitch by a pitcher named Carl Mays. And today we have the director of the film, Andy Billman, with us, who's previously worked for ESPN. This is an independent project, and we're very excited to help spread the word and really super, super excited to I guess, ask some questions because, again, I was really blown away by it. One, Andy, thank you for joining, and two, how's it going, man?
It's going great. You know, let's go Mets. Buy that film. Bush play. Honored to be here. And thank you for that nice lead. And being a Clevelander, it's I've been to Citi Field. It's a wonderful place. And yes, I'm very excited to talk about a project that kind of fell in my lap and a storyline of a team that I really root for a lot.
Well, I mean, you know, I want to start from the beginning, but I guess I'll start from my beginning. Sure. As a baseball fan in the 90s, I was a teenager, my formative years. You know, those Cleveland Yankees series were outstanding. You know, those Cleveland teams were just unbelievable. And, you know, the fire and the postseason lore that was kind of tied up with that, you know, from an outsider's perspective, it's like, wow, that was a really a peak in baseball. And then watching your film and seeing, I guess, for at least from Cleveland's perspective, and of course from the Yankees as well, but from Cleveland's perspective, the rivalry that's grown over, you know, and this is no exaggeration, over the last century is extremely layered. It's and it, you know, it all kind of starts with a terrific player in his time, Ray Chapman, who, you know, a lot of people know him as a guy as the only major leaguer to die on the field of play. You know, over his span, which was 1912 to 1920, 28th in wins above replacement, which of course, you know, Fangraphs is able to pull that up. But what a well-rounded player. I mean, a 278 average is pedestrian for the time. Not pedestrian, but solid, but, you know, nothing to write home about. 358 on base percentage. He's one of the highest rated base runners in the league. His defense was just through the roof.
Yeah.
You know, there was so much to go along with Ray Chapman, and you guys did a real good job of kind of telling his story up to and through his early demise. Would you care to just give us like a quick run through of your experience building the film?
Sure. So I'll take it in two parts. So there's the rivalry aspect of this film, and obviously for Mets fans, they probably feel the same for the Yankees, and that's true. there, I'm a big believer in studying sports and the importance of rivalries. I like rivalries. I think they really what drives us. And for the Mets, I would assume it's the Braves, definitely the Yankees. And, you know, and obviously from the Cleveland perspective, it's really the White Sox and Yankees. That's really the two teams that have really pushed the buttons of the Indians. And so it really started in 1920 with a team of the Indians that was coming on the rise with Ray Chapman, who was the star player of the team that you alluded to, Tress Speaker, legendary Hall of Famer, and many other players, Joel Sewell, who was a legendary Hall of Famer, who actually replaced Chapman later in the year. And ironically, it was the same year that the Yankees had gotten Ruth. So in 20, it was the Indians and Yankees, along with the White Sox in the background, who was still, even after the Black Sox scandal, was still a very good team. And that really didn't get settled out until the end of September. So the White Sox are still the White Sox at that time. Say this three-team race. But really, for most of the season, it was focused on the Yankees and Indians. And the Indians were considered the favorites by most to win the World Series. And the Yankees, it was kind of conflicted, but they all knew about Ruth. And obviously, when Ruth took off, the Yankees took off, and it made for a great pennant race. And it all culminated on that August day. And so from an Indians fan perspective, from my perspective, that's really what started the rivalry. Our star player and star, you know, really a star of the town, Ray Chapman, died tragically from a pitch. And ironically, somehow the Indians gathered themselves and still won the World Series, which is amazing to think of that. And there's a lot of Cleveland fans who probably don't know the story of that whole season. When I was growing up in the 80s, you never talked about 20. You always talked about 48, 54, and you talked about other maybe memories in the, you know, in that time period, but really Rocky Colavito, you know, Barker's perfect game, but like you really never talked about 20. So I think for a lot of Clevelanders, that's what we're bringing that story up. It's going to come through. And then obviously there's a timeline of moments. Feller and DiMaggio were very good friends, and Feller had a very tumultuous relationship with New York. He had an autobiography, and he pretty much stated, "I hate the Yankees" throughout. And that became a big part of it. And the Yankees fans obliged by teasing him a lot. So there was that love-hate relationship there. Obviously, in 48, the year before the Yankees won the series in 47 and 48, the Indians overtook the Yankees and won the World Series. 49 and 53 was a great – usually the Indians were in second place all those years or in third between 49 and 53. And then the Indians came back in 54 with an historical win mark. In fact, the 54 Yankees were the most wins ever by a single-managed team, but yet the Indians won the AL pennant that year. And so there's all those different types of memories. And then you throw in what happened in the 90s, as you described, the 2000s, what happened this year, obviously, too, with the Yankees and Guardians now. And then you throw in some storylines like George Steinbrenner. He is from Cleveland. He actually tried to – his dream growing up was to own the Cleveland Indians, only to be rebuffed by the Yankees, which is
and the monster that they created. And he turned his attention to New York, and that was, you know, that was that.
Yeah, it was that. So for people who really justify things, there was, you know, I'll put it in this perspective. The Yankees and Royals had a fantastic rivalry in the late 70s, early 80s. But obviously that kind of dissipated over time. So to compare to people, this is over 100 years. And as long as there is a family called Steinbrenner owning the Yankees, that is a Bay Village, Ohio family. Sure. They grew up rooting for the Indians. So that's as rivalry as it gets, in my opinion. So that's kind of the historical ride, with the main theme being what happened in 1920 between Ray Chapman of the Indians and Carl Mays of the Yankees.
Now, you spoke briefly about Ray Chapman being almost like a Prince of Cleveland sort of situation. I mean, married to a wealthy socialite, a Cleveland darling, a very powerful Cleveland family. Yeah. Very tabloid coverage of the wedding. You know, this guy was, you know, pretty much etched in the stone of Cleveland history, or well on his way to being so, right?
Yes. For people who don't know, Chapman married a woman named Katie Daly in 1919. And that was a big, big deal. And in fact, you will find articles written in even in Oklahoma about how big of a wedding it was between Ray Chapman and Katie Daly. It made basically at that time period as a national story. That was not a little thing, because the Daly family owned a huge oil company in Cleveland. So they were very wealthy. And at that time, Ray was going to go off and retire because he was marrying into wealth. And his new father-in-law said, look, why work? Take a desk job, put your feet up and live on the money. And he was considering doing that. And Trev Speaker kind of talked him out of it, who was his best friend and player manager of the team, talked him into playing in 1920. So he was a starlet. Katie Daly, I mean, was a starlet. They were stars. That was a huge deal in Cleveland. But again, if you do a simple research in that time where they got married, the story was in a lot of publications throughout the country. And so it wasn't just like a little thing in Cleveland. It was a bigger story that was told throughout the nation. And so it was obviously when the moment happened where he died, it was the same kind of reaction. It was in a lot of papers for a few weeks about what happened that day in the Polo Grounds. So it was a big story. They were a power couple, and they were really built in some people's eyes. You can find Mr. and Mrs. Cleveland in 1920.
Incredible. Now, Carl Mays, the pitcher who hit Chapman with the pitch, didn't show. I mean, he already had a reputation for being an aggressive pitcher. Mm-hmm. Didn't really show much emotion at the time, per reports, right?
Well, I mean, he even said it himself. I don't think the guy had. For people who don't know, we actually got an audio recording of Carl. Carl was going to do an autobiography in the late '60s. Of his life, and he obviously never finished it because he passed away. But we were able to uncover, I found the article talking about his audio recording, and so we were able to unearth that audio. So there's two sides of this too. We got to be fair to Mr. Mays. The 1890s and early 1900s in Kentucky and Missouri were not good times. It was a very rough time. It was a very different time period, very different game, to be honest with you.
The players themselves were just
hardened.
Folks.
Oh, hardened. I mean, there are people who describe it as the Wild West. I mean, who brags about sharpening their spikes, cleating people? Ty Cobb. I mean, that's what kind of people we're talking about. And that Cobb Mays era, I wouldn't say was all the way the norm, but it wasn't unusual either. It was really played by a bunch of there's a gentleman in my film named Randy Roberts, who's a big historian of baseball. And it was just, it would almost be like if you're a lion tamer at the circus and, you know, the lion happened to eat the lion tamer. Well, that's kind of the danger of it. Well, baseball was dangerous. It was not a clean game. It was a very hard game. It was kind of wild. I mean, to tell you how crazy it was, owners didn't even exchange balls sometimes, meaning they only played with like 11 or 12 balls. So like if a ball got hit out of the park, the owners would be like, get that ball back. Like, wait, that needs to come back and play. So it was just a very different time. And so for Mays, he grew up in the Midwest of Missouri, as he would say in a microphone. And so because of that, he's a very hardened individual. But there was more Carl Mays then than there are obviously today.
Sure.
So in fairness to Mays, he grew up in a time period that was very different, and the game was very different. Now, all that to be said, I think some of his audio is still jarring.
Yeah.
And it's still very surprising to hear some of the things he said. And there's a great story that we bring up in the film about him basically beating the shit out of a guy on a train over a card game.
The card game. I saw that, and that stuck with me.
That's crazy. But that was baseball. I mean, that kind of was it. And you know, if you listen to his stories, I mean, just a different game, but you know, he was a competitor. And do I think he meant to hurt anyone? Absolutely not. No. Does he believe that was his plate and he was trying to protect his plate? Yes. And he was very protective of that. So that's something that people should keep in mind too.
He had the benefit of him not mincing his words
whatsoever. No. There's no.
You don't have to question his motives. I mean, you know, he very plainly states his position in it, and whether it's fair or not, whether we agree if it's fair or not, it's not really up to us. It's just a kind of an account of what happened from a firsthand
participant. Yeah. I mean, look, as soon as I heard it, I'm like, your first words are not, geez, I'm really sorry. I felt terrible. I haven't been able to sleep for weeks. No, it was just like, yeah, you ran the ball. What do you want?
Yeah.
Which again, in that time period though, was how it went. Obviously, healthcare in 1920s at a baseball game was not what it was today. Not even close. So to a lot of people who saw the incident, and it was bad. I mean, Babe Ruth described it as it sounded like a loud ball going off a metal beam. Jeez, I mean, that's terrible to hear something like that. But again, even at that time, everybody thought he would be okay because that's kind of what people believed and thought. So it just kind of that time period, but Carl Mays definitely fit in there. And he's obviously remorseful someone died, yes, but is he remorseful for what happened? No.
Sure. And that's kind of the vibe that you took from him. And again, different time, different games, yes. different types of players.
Yes.
And, you know, incomparable to today's game. But do you feel like the city of Cleveland, who of course loves their baseball, loves their sports, but and there was success after, but, you know, and it's tough to kind of gauge it now, but was there that reeling feeling at the time, or was, you know, with Speaker in the mix and other talented players, was it, you know, I hate to be crass, but did time just kind of keep on moving?
Yeah, I would say to your line, it was a false celebration. A lot of people had a very hard time. They had a parade in 20 after the Indians won, and the parade ended in chaos because people were grieving over Chapman.
Wow.
And so that it just speaks to another level again of how 1920 was never really been properly celebrated. And obviously so, a man died in the middle of the season. That's terrible. So it makes sense. So I guess to your point, you know, as we all realize, sadly, these things happen. And, you know, you think of other incidents that were terrible like that, like Hank Gathers and other things like that. And, you know, as you start to learn, like, you know, they're going to keep tipping them off at some point. Throw the first pitch. And I think for Cleveland's perspective, it was a championship, yes, but it was a championship never really celebrated.
Yeah.
And so because of that, I think it obviously left a mark on the Indians, as it should. And they were still very good, but they weren't. 1920 was just a magic elixir. And in fairness too, the Yankees just became a juggernaut with Babe. And I think everything kind of changed after that season. So yes, time did move on, but I think the Indians had a very hard time moving on. And, you know, we don't get into it. Sonny Jim Dunn, who was, I would say, the best owner the Indians ever had, he years later would be, and not too far removed from the championship, he would die suddenly. So, like, there's other moments that kind of just happened where I think it kind of, I don't know what the right word is, it just didn't seem peppy. And honestly, yeah, it did. And as it should. I mean, that kind of event, you're going to have that. And honestly, Feller brought a big energy to the ball club. And that really kind of changed things again in the 30s.
Oh, and he was incredible. I love the parts with him in the film. I think that was, you know, just kind of speaking to the history of Cleveland and how it all interlocks together from start to finish and even to today's game. It was just an incredible journey to watch. And I have to assume you guys had you're a Cleveland sports fan. You have to be just as, I guess, proud and the journey itself must have been just as fun going through it yourself, right?
Well, I never really learned much about 20s growing up. I never really heard about it. In fact, I would be debating if there's a lot of people in Cleveland who realize Tress Speaker played for the Indians. I just don't think 20 celebrated. And again, I get it. It's because the guy died. It just doesn't get brought up for obvious reasons. I think this gives a chance, yeah, to learn some more about the history. But also for me, obviously being a diehard, it helped me learn and understand some things about why things went down the way they did in years later. Because when you have something like that happen, you said it, well, it takes your wind out of your sails. And
sure.
It kind of makes it feel funky. And that was a big deal in 1920 to beat Babe Ruth and to win the pennant and to go on and beat the Brooklyn Robins, now LA Dodgers. Man, it's a huge World Series win.
Sure.
And it just doesn't get celebrated. There's probably a lot of people don't know about it. And I think that obviously took a lot of their mojo out of it. And it just changed. But it did help me learn about that. It helped me understand. And obviously, you start doing a deeper dive into your ball club, it helps you realize some things that weirdly still go on today that kind of were going on for years. They just never realized until you start really studying it. And there's definitely some parallels that were going on in 1920 and are still going on today in 2022.
Just great stuff. And you guys were able to pull up a pretty cool relic from the time as well. I'm not sure if you want to share or leave that for the film, but boy, almost brought tears to my eyes.
Yeah. I mean, there's like a lot of things that we did some reenactments. We did some things that documentarians do that I think we took a big risk on. I think they worked. And we try to really bring to life about what, because obviously when you're doing a story in 1920, you want to put a today's touch on it. Mm-hmm. And so I think through reenactments and then the finding of this plaque story that happened, a lot of people don't know, Ray Chapman obviously had a plaque and an honorary thing to honor his death and his legendary status in Cleveland. And sadly, that plaque went missing for a long time and it was just recently found. So it kind of also brings into, it just brings in a full circle, the finding of this plaque and everything that's been going on. And yeah, I mean, look, there's a lot of, look, I think it was Verducci said it. And I know at one point, Maniloff said it. There's a lot of layers to Indians, Yankees, a lot. And as I said, there's still some today. Obviously, what happened this year in the playoffs is kind of spunky. There's nothing more fun than riding on the Mets.
That's a fun team. That's a fun team.
Yeah,
it's not going
yeah
out,
we're very lucky. And by the way, the Mets helped us out a lot with Jimenez and Rosario.
What a great trade.
By the way, but worked right for both teams.
Yeah.
Because once the Mets start, I was cheering for you guys. I really want to see you guys win. Carrasco, when healthy, is a big pitcher in big spots. So that I mean, it's not, I know Lindor is a focus, but Carrasco can really pitch. He's a very likable guy. But anyways, you know, it's fun riding home on Metro North. I went to game two. And it's fun listening to the Yankees fan saying, that was such a Cleveland win. It's like, what do you mean? He goes, well, we wouldn't bunt to start the game. Like, geez Louise, really? And ironically, 1920, the Indians were bunting and playing a game that was very different, and the Yankees were hitting home runs. So
yeah,
102 years later, it's still the same stuff. It's just different times. That's it.
It is. But really, I can't express enough gratitude for one, sharing the screening with me. I really enjoyed it. Two, coming on. The film premieres on the 15th of November. So it's 15th, coming up next week.
15th, go on to Amazon or Apple TV. You just type in War in the Diamond. You can buy it, purchase it. It'll be ready for you. It's very affordable, $5. Do what you got to do to watch it. And like I said, warinthediamond.com will give you more information and you can check it out anytime. That's warinthediamond.com, Apple, Amazon, or any VOD platform. So if you have Xfinity or you have Comcast, you can buy it on those platforms as well.
Excellent. 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 Andy, again, thank you so much for coming on. Go Tribe. I know it's not the Tribe anymore. It's Guardians, but
go Guards, go Gardos.
By the way, are you happy with the brand change, the name change? I really think they hit it on the head. I mean, I was iffy at first, but that's pretty cool. I think they tied in the city with it. And
look, I'll be brief. Is that going on? Not this forever. When you lose your team like the Browns, it's just nice having your team in town. So I was very different from most fans. I did not feel that. I mean, the Indians were the name I grew up with. Yes. I don't get attached to team names like other fans do. My dad had a very hard time with it. People who are very close to me had a very hard time, angry about it. I'm good with it. It's good. It's fine. Guardians is a good name. I mean, it's fine. It works. It's good. When you win, by the way, the name sounds a lot better. You know, your first Guardians in the world. So I talk about it a lot. And, you know, if people want to get a real perspective, I have an Instagram handle called @officialclevelandsports. And I do post games. It has 140,000 plus followers. And I do post games after every Guardians game. And that would get brought up a lot. And one of the things I'd always tell the fans, like, look, like, we get it. Our memories are for this. But the most important thing is it's Cleveland baseball. Yeah. That's the most important thing. Guardians it works. It's a cool name. I won't lie to you, Tim. It helps when you win. Sure. So I think the Guardians Indians chatter, I will admit, after October finally started going away, which was nice. That it was wearing me down. I'm sure it was wearing down others too. So it's nice that's kind of going away. And I understand, and I'm very sympathetic to those who still hate the name change. I get it. I'm just not that guy. I just don't get attached to names like other fans do.
Oh, you know, there's so many of us who just aren't good with change. You know.
Oh, buddy, I know. I teach at a university. I tell kids all the time, like, change happens. Yeah. And you have to embrace change. And, I mean, I won't elaborate anymore than you said. There's a lot of us who will have a good cocktail or do something else when name changes happen. And, again, the passion came out when the name change happened. And I get it. I get it. And you're right. We all handle change differently. And to be truthful, there's a lot of memories behind the name Indian. So I understand why people are having a hard time with it.
Hey, you know, it's like we said, it's change, and you just kind of, everyone embraces it at their own pace. But Andy,
that's right.
I can't thank you enough. Everybody, it's called War on the Diamond. It's out on November 15th. As Andy mentioned, it's across all streaming platforms, your cable platforms as well. Probably check out the trailer that's on YouTube right now. I believe there's a Twitter, War on the Diamond. Yep. You can check it out everywhere. And I believe we're going to have a couple of giveaways. Maybe we'll give away some free copies of the show on Amazon or something to that effect on the giveaway day. We'll figure that out once we get there. But Andy, thanks so much again, man.
Thank you, Tim.
All right. All right, everybody. We'll be back. Have some more Mets chatter to get to. And yeah, hang tight. We'll be right back.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watching on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510, is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
All right, we are back. Speaking of we are back, Taryn, welcome back, buddy.
Hey, Tim. Good to be back, man. It was a nice break getting acclimated to work and getting sworn into the bar and stuff like that. And so it's... We've got some more to talk about now because it's the off season, and I'm excited.
You see, when I hear sworn into the bar, I hear very, very different things in my head.
That's right. That's you watching the Mets out on the town. That's sworn into the bar.
Oh yeah. Well, I've been, you know, sworn in and sworn out of the bar if we're going to be getting into the details, but not today. The Mets have so much on their plate right now. There's already little fires cooking everywhere. I think Edwin Diaz, we spoke briefly on the last episode just to kind of give a rundown of what we were hearing, what we were learning. We did get a breakdown of the money, and I think people were kind of taken aback by the money, but I think it's a good thing. I do have the breakdown here. We have $17.25 million this year and next year. Well, this coming season and season after, that's 23 and 24. 17 and a half and 25. Then he's got a player option after 25. 26 and 27 are both 18.5 million. A team option after that in 27 and 28th will be a 17.25 million. Now, over the course of that deal, he's got 26.5 million deferred, which is works out to 2.65 million a year for 10 years from 2033 to 2042. People are seeing this and they're freaking out. Can you talk us off the ledge a little bit? Because this is actually a good thing, right?
Yeah. Is that you're blowing up or I'm blowing up? Yeah. I think that this is the way that top end relievers are going to be paid. And I know that that's like a very up and down position, but you can see what a difference it can make. I mean, the Mets definitely don't win 100 games without Diaz being what he was this year. So I thought getting him back was critical. If that was the money that it was going to take, that's fine. It seems like a lot of that, or at least a significant portion of that, is going to be deferred. They're not going to be, paying him when he's not necessarily in his prime. Like, there's good chance that he could be great throughout this this contract. So I think making sure that you have the closer locked in, he has adapted well to New York now after a couple of years that were a little up and down. And he was phenomenal last year. He was a really great source of joy to watch as a fan, right? So I'm excited that they made it a point to bring him back right off the bat. And now it kind of sets the course going forward, right? So they'll figure out what's next.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the deferrals kind of lead into that whole process because, I guess with his deferrals being what they are, his annual average salary is 18.6 million. So that counts against the luxury tax total and gives the Mets a little bit more wiggle room to, fill out the rest of their, if we're looking directly at it, the rest of their pitching staff. I mean, the starting rotation, which we'll get to in a second, is looking quite bare. The bullpen's looking even worse right now. I mean, this is per Fangraphs. This is what the Mets bullpen looks like right now. Edwin Diaz, Drew Smith, Bryce Montes de Oca, Steven Nogosic, Yoan Lopez, John Curtis, Taylor Saucedo. I don't even know how to say that.
Saucedo, the guy that they.
Is it Saucedo?
I don't know. I'm guessing.
I'm going to see what that sauce do. Taylor sauce do. No, I think so. Yeah, Saucedo sounds right. Saucedo. And Jose Buto. And, there's going to be a lot of work to do there. And, there's a lot of work to do in a lot of different places. But, trimming what's a extremely substantial multi-year contract for a guy like Edwin Diaz. Again, a very deserved and a very fair contract for what he brings to the table. But, you look at $20 million a year and it's like, wow. With the deferrals, it's a little bit easier to swallow, but the Mets, now you have to go out and fill so many other holes. And I think, having a few extra dollars can't hurt that. I just don't feel like this is going to be a team that's going to, cut corners and nickel and dime their way into 100 wins again. I think that they kind of know what's ahead of them and know what has to be done. And kind of feels like the first step in many, right?
Yeah. And I think that the bare cupboard that you outline makes it pretty clear that there's a lot of work to be done. The decision that they made on Givens, basically, agreeing that that was not necessarily a success and doesn't really bode well for his contributions in the future, just deciding to cut ties with him. I thought that was fine, but that's another guy that would have pitched a significant number of innings for a bullpen. So there's, you've at least got to hope that Billy and Steve have a plan in place. And I'm sure that they do because that's, that's the job, But yeah, I think Edwin, the money is not like ridiculous, right? Like it's a lot of money for a reliever because we haven't seen a ton of relievers make that average annual value. But like if you consider that, I think according to Fangraphs, he was worth probably around 3 wins last year. The value of a win on the free agent market in any given year is somewhere between like $7 and $9 million. Okay. It's typically towards the lower end of that. But if you consider 3 wins, $7 million, that's $21 million. So his compensation will be right in line or even maybe a bit of a better deal for the Mets if he is able to repeat a phenomenal season. But even if he's a 2-win closer or something like that, and throws a lot of innings, I still think that it could be a good deal, a solid deal. But the Mets made this deal to continue to be in a win now mode. You don't pay up for a closer if you're not planning on spending in other areas to compete. So they've spent this money and they're going to be on to the next thing, which I would think is not only shoring up the rotation, because they've got to figure out what they're doing with DeGrom. And I know that we want to talk about that because now Bassett has opted out as well. But what they are going to do with the middle of their lineup. It was clear that, you know, the stringing 5 or 6 hits together during the regular season, you know, it can be done. And the Mets really made it an art last year. That doesn't necessarily work when you're facing some of the best pitchers in baseball. And so I think that there needs to be a concerted effort to get more pop in the lineup, somebody that can really change the game with one swing of a bat, because it's not just that we saw Philly do it this year. It's that we saw Atlanta do it last year. And if you watched the World Series in 2019, what were the big hits? It was like Soto's home run, Howie Kendrick's home run, Anthony Rendon's home run. Those are the big hits that you think about, and those are the ones that end up winning rings. So if the Mets are going to make it a point to go deep in October, and that's what Steve has said that he wants, this is the beginning of that 3 to 5 year window that he talked about, right?
Sure.
They need to spend to get a big bat in the middle of the lineup, somebody that can complement Pete.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the number one guy on anyone's list is Aaron Judge, but you have to think, at least from a realistic perspective, that's probably a bridge too far for the Mets. I think they've already said that, you know, you can't really take what anybody says publicly with more than a grain of salt right now, but I don't foresee the Mets making a strong push. Of course, they should. You know, he's going to be looking at a 7-8 year, $300+ million deal. But, you know, for a player like that, he's well worth it. I did like how the buzz that Trey Turner has been getting, and I know that he's not an Aaron Judge type guy, but since 2019, top 2 players in Major League Baseball in F4 are Aaron Judge and Trey Turner. And now Trey Turner's, you know, the 5-tool player. He's got that pop that you're looking for, but he can do everything else too. Yes. He's not Aaron Judge. And I think I know what you're saying when you need pop in the lineup, consistent pop in the lineup, because, you know, a 3-run homer can be the difference between a wild card series loss and a trip to the NLCS. You know what I mean? Like, anything like this can happen, but you can look, you know, up and down the lists in certain, you know, aspects. You know, I think the Mets have been lacking offensively in the catcher position. They could look at a guy like Wilson Contreras if the money's right. You know, pitching wise, I know we were talking about hitting, but they got a lot of holes to fill there. And you got to think, I guess you got to be wary of the qualifying offer and, you know, Carlos Rodon and Contreras and Turner, who we just talked about. But, you know, the Mets have so many different directions they can go, but their end game or their goal is very clear. Fill out the rotation, fill out the bullpen, add some pop to the lineup, and keep whatever you had going, you know, moving right along. Because there's a nice foundation here. And, you know, it's still so early to know how things develop on the open market, how things develop on the, you know, the phone call or text message or email market as far as trade and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I think there's going to be a lot cooking over the next few weeks. And, you know, we can peg, you know, Jacob DeGrom, say where he's going to go, or Brandon Nimmo, say where he's going to go, or Chris Bassett, however you want to put it. But, you know, I think there's going to be a lot of layers that are going to be peeled away. And I'm with you. The Mets have a plan in place. You know, they pretty much have to. But there's going to be so many different pots on so many different, you know, stovetops that it's going to be I think it's going to be wild. But it's like Jake, how Jake kind of falls into place, that's like almost a domino for the rest of the Mets, right?
It definitely is, as far as the rotation goes, right? Like if you're not going to be able to keep DeGrom, if DeGrom goes to Texas or St. Louis or somewhere else, right? The effect is that you have to replace that second ace at the top of the rotation. And whether that's Verlander or it is Rodon or even this guy Senga, who might be, you know, maybe he's a number three, that'll be crucial. And there'll also be availability on the trade market. You know, maybe a guy like Zach Gallen is available.
You speak my language there, pal.
Yeah.
Oh, I've been going at that for years.
Right. And so there are going to be guys that are available, and we might not see it telegraphed. We haven't necessarily seen every move that the Mets are going to be made leaked and telegraphed like it has been under previous regimes. So it might just end up being a surprise. But the good news is that this market is pretty, to take one of Billy's terms, robust. And I think there are a lot of ways for the Mets to improve. And I would love to have Judge, obviously. I think Judge brings a ton of star power. The fact that he has made himself like a superb center fielder is fantastic. But I think that the Mets could also get better, and this is not a consolation prize by any means, but like if you sign Trey Turner or you sign Carlos Correa, that gives you more pop in the lineup, and those guys are phenomenal in the field. You put them at second, and then move McNeil, ship Marte over, and then, you know, you could get a defensive center fielder for cheap at the deadline. I think that's a really good lineup as well. But the point is that they need one more hitter. It was painful to watch the Mets just kind of like scuffle through the last 6 to 8 weeks of the season, and then obviously it ends in that disappointment, but just not getting the big hit, and it just never came. So
where do you look? Do you look at like a Jose Abreu to try and fill out the DH spot? I mean, Vogelback's back, and he's back real cheap, and if he can, you know, if they can find the right matchups for him and he could still be that productive part-time player, that's great, but you need more, right?
Yeah, you definitely do. But that's why I'm saying that you would want it in the form of an everyday player, I think, more than just like a DH type. Like if you think about Trey Turner, the number of positions that he's played, he even played center field, I think, for the Nats at times when they needed it. So
yeah,
this is a guy that you can plug and play anywhere. He averages something like 25 home runs over a full season played.
He's a 100 run, 100 RBI caliber player.
His speed is unbelievable. It's just game-changing speed. He's so smooth. All of his actions are beautiful. They'll probably age well. So for me, I would love to have him. I think that he's a great player.
I'm with you 100%.
So if the Mets can do that, or if they, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of Correa. I think he should be probably better than he is. But even he, I think, would be great in the lineup, and that would be fun, like having a Puerto Rican middle infield.
It would be awesome. I mean, you can move newly minted silver slugger, like you said, Jeff McNeil around. And again, we already said it previously, how it's very tough to take anything you hear these days about, you know, where players might go or where there's interest, you know, the whole DeGrom thing. You know, I think you need deep pocketed places for DeGrom's value to be boosted. And I think Texas is a perfect place for that. And I wouldn't be shocked if he has genuine interest to move down there. But, you know, after the last deal that he signed, he's looking to milk all he can out of this deal. And I think he circles back to the Mets and they just, you know, blow anyone else's offer out of the water and keep him here through his career. But, you know, moving on from DeGrom, you know, if you have a Turner in the mix, if you have I like Correa. I think Correa would fit so well in this lineup where no one's looking at him to be the guy. Of course, he's going to be a highly paid free agent acquisition, and he will have, you know, pressure and expectations. But when you have a roster with Lindor and Pete Alonso and whoever else this team adds, you know, it's pretty much just like, at least to me, it's not okay. You know how Lindor kind of was deer in the headlights that first season?
Yeah.
Because he was like that, you know, he was here, this is your superstar and this is the rest of your team. Well, now you've got, you know, budding and developing superstars. I think Alonso's taking that, you know, cross that threshold. I think McNeil is, you know, even if he's not the power threat, he is of that ilk, I guess you could say. You know, adding a guy like Correa or Turner is just going to, you know, keep that beat moving. They're just going to, you know, in a perfect world, just a seamless transition and everyone keeps it moving forward. And that's how I see those types of additions.
I agree with you in theory, but like I watched a lot of Correa this year, you know, being that he was here in Minnesota. And I think he was kind of like being counted upon to be the guy. And I'm not sure that he really rose to that level.
Don't you think that he would kind of fall under that radar if he were on a Mets roster surrounded by other star level guys?
I'm not sure that he, like anywhere that he goes, that he wouldn't be like a target, a big name. And because the money is going to be there, the name, his involvement with the Astros.
Yeah, but look at Springer. Like Springer went to Toronto and he, you know, he's produced, he's also had some injury issues, but you know, it's almost like the Houston thing almost melted away once he got to Toronto. You don't think that happens if he finds success wherever it is, whether it's in New York, whether wherever he goes.
Yeah, you know, no, and I'm not saying that people didn't like him here. I'm just saying that I don't think that he could be in a situation where he's like incognito. I think that anywhere that Carlos Correa plays the rest of his career, he will be one of the faces of the franchise. I'm not sure how he handled that level of pressure this year.
You have to think that New York is going to be like that pressure times a million.
It would be, of course. And you know, when you play in this division, also you have to travel to some places where you're going to play in front of some really rowdy fans. Not to mention like very demanding home fans. So we'll see. I don't know. I mean, you can't go wrong by adding a super talented player like Carlos Correa, but I would say that the gap in my preference between him and Trey Turner is significant.
Oh, I'm
I would also throw Bogarts into that mix. I'm not sure, because we also don't know, do these guys, it's a loaded shortstop class, right? There's four of them.
Yeah.
Do they want to play shortstop? Because a lot of guys want to play shortstop. They don't want to move off that spot. And so they won't go places where they're not going to be penciled in, and we already have a shortstop.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And then you also have to look at the, you know, and this is with an eye towards Alvarez, it's an eye towards Mauricio, it's an eye towards Beatty. You know, these guys are all pretty much bubbled up to this level now. You kind of have to take that into account when, okay, well, if Correa does want to play third base, well, what are we looking at as far as Beatty? What are we looking at? I mean, obviously, if you have the ability to add a player of that caliber, whether it's Correa, whether it's someone else willing to play third by a trade, whatever, you know, you look, say, well, Beatty could be a good player one day, but this is a win now ball club. So, you know, you kind of weigh that option. But, you know, look at the winter that Mauricio's had. Do you think that he fits somewhere? And so many layers and so many decisions this front office has to make this winter. It's crazy.
I think Mauricio would be a really nice trade chip.
Stop that right now.
I think he's going to be good,
but I'm getting to the point that, yeah, unless the Mets are willing to move him around defensively and see if he sticks, at this point, his value is just, you know, Fangraphs has him like 32 on their top one, whatever it is. It's not 100. It's like 100 and change. But
yeah, but even with a guy like Beatty or Vientos or, you know, any of these guys, I maybe not Alvarez, but even him, I would throw into this group that they're all movable to get the pieces to win now. This team, the way that it's built, they have enough key pieces that are on the wrong side of 30 that you have to be focused on the here and now. And that's why I was so disappointed with the trade deadline too. It's not like so many great players got moved, but I don't think that the Mets were aggressive enough at the deadline to get the pieces that they needed to make a strong enough push. But yeah, you know, also, who knows, right? Like, they could have done more aggressive things, and it doesn't matter because none of it makes sense.
I finally went back and looked at the standings today, and seeing, you know, the Braves and the Mets tied at 101 and 61. It's just it's almost human nature to look back and say, oh, what about this? And oh, what about that one? And oh, what about this series? But boy, I mean, that's, I guess, the gift and the curse of 162, that you can nitpick one by one, but it's also it's a full painting at the end of the thing. I think you know what I'm getting at.
Of course. And it would have been so frustrating even if we had, you know, held off Atlanta and won the division. It would have been nice to say, oh, we won the division, but it also would have been extremely frustrating to lose to them instead of to Philadelphia instead of losing to San Diego also.
Yeah.
So arguably maybe have even felt worse. So who's to say, but
that's what we're here for. We're just
there are things that the Mets can certainly do to get better. And I'm excited about the number of options that they have. Who is in a situation kind of like Bassett, would you say, this year? Like, obviously the Bassett trade came out of nowhere, but you can see that the Mets were kind of like targeting guys that had great peripherals and just hadn't necessarily exploded onto the scene yet. They were coming from teams that aren't necessarily willing to pay them longer term. Who would you say is in a situation like that, contract-wise and team-wise?
Yeah, it's tough to say. I mean, you can look at those. And I know he got bombed in the series against the Yankees, but I wouldn't necessarily peg him as a guy for the Mets, but I think that Aaron Civale going to a different organization, going to somewhere that could just put a different set of eyes on his stuff, which he has good stuff, but it just looks like maybe he's stalled out a bit in Cleveland. I think that he's a potential candidate to be moved and see gains somewhere. As far as the Mets, you know, Merrill Kelly always, I know you brought up Zach Allen before. Merrill Kelly really flies under the radar in Arizona, as many people do. Mm-hmm. I think that's a guy who could, you know, and look, you know, you could pretty much look at Bassett and be like, well, you know, this was a top 10 ERA guy for 3 years. Nobody really knew who he was. And Merrill Kelly's pretty much the same type thing when he's on. He's, you know, terrific. You put him in a mid rotation spot, and you know he could be a very, very just a really productive, you know, key cog piece. I know that. I think who was it? Heyman was talking about Pablo Lopez possibly being on the trade block, which that's enticing.
Yeah, I think that they tried to move him at the deadline too. I'm interested to see if teams are willing to pay more. I imagine that would be probably more of a backup option after we see how free agency goes.
Absolutely. I'm curious to see how Martin Perez shakes out. I know everyone's kind of expecting him to go back to Texas. He was comfortable there. He was just on a 1-year deal, I think, out of Boston.
But yeah, I think it was a prove it. Yep.
Yeah. And really had a very, very nice season. I think that's a perfect, you know, 3-4 compliment to, you have to think Cookie's going to be in the mix. How do you feel about $14 million for Cookie? He was a little inconsistent. What are you down with that $14 million?
I think he ate a lot of good innings for the Mets. He didn't necessarily show up against the best teams that the Mets played, but I thought that he was a valuable contributor. Again, like $14 million, like it sounds like a bigger number than it is for an open market. And just to be able to know that you have one guy like kind of in place, I thought that the value was fine.
Yeah, no, and I think he could be a solid provider, a solid contributor. You just kind of have to bear with it when he doesn't have it. And you know, I think that's the same could be said for anybody. But yeah, I think in the time that he's been in Queens, you know, Carrasco's had trouble finding that rhythm. Once he finds it, he's fine. But sometimes he gets a little out of whack, as we all do. Like, how about a guy like Marco Gonzalez coming out of Seattle, who has been a solid, solid piece in the back end of the rotation, you know, as a number five guy, as opposed to, let's say, a Peterson or Lucchese, or even just to, you know, spark that internal competition. I'm okay with taking a flyer on a back of the rotation guy who's been okay in recent years.
Yeah, I think so. And the other thing is that I trust Jeremy Hefner. I think that there's a reason why the Mets have invested in Hef also. So giving him pieces to play with, I think, is a good call.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's going to be it's going to be an exciting winter, and I think the Mets just picked up a former Reds, former Driveline guy as an assistant pitching director. I could remember his name.
Yeah, which, you know, there's I see it as a good thing to get more people that are interested in looking at more data points and possibly using that information to gear towards player development. I think that is this next wave of, you know, the quote unquote analytics is figuring out the best way to apply it to player development. And that's happening everywhere. And the Mets get smarter when they do stuff like that.
Yeah. Oh, you know, I like Cole Irvin. And you know, that Oakland likes to trade their guys when there's any sort of value to them. Him and James Caprellian, who was a former Yankees draft pick, I want to say. Yeah, two very nice arms. You package Sean Murphy in with one of those guys, and you're knocking out a couple of stones in one throw.
Getting Sean Murphy would be fantastic.
Oh, yeah. I have friends in Boston who are just salivating over bringing him in.
The Mets haven't had a donk like that at catcher since Anthony Record.
You know, to put up with that can, it's an impressive feat. Record, that thing was a dump truck. Still is, I'm sure, but you know, we don't get to look at it.
Yeah.
Good times. Nice to have you back, buddy.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're going to give us plenty of news here. We'll figure out what's going on with the outfield, figure out if Conforto will be back.
Conforto.
What they do with the prospects. There's like so many things up in the air for this team right now. And, you know, 101 wins, but not achieving the ultimate goal, even though the regular season was so fun. I like that there is that fire, and I hope that Cohen is driving the front office to make these more aggressive moves and put them in a position that they could be the last team standing this year.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, that's the ultimate goal. That's what everyone wants right now. That's what everyone was so let down about after, you know, fizzing out in the wild card series. You know, this team, this franchise, this organization, this fan base, everybody, they're ready for that next step. And, you know, maybe it'll be a couple of next steps. Maybe, you know, maybe you have to work towards an NLCS. And then maybe you have to work even harder towards a World Series in another season. But, you know, as long as you're seeing incremental progress, I'm okay with that. How the rest of the fan base is, you know, adjusts to patience will yet to be determined.
Yeah. And I wanted to say one more thing. So with the Astros, I couldn't believe that they didn't extend James Click for longer than a year. And I've met James Click a couple times. He's a very smart guy, very nice guy. But to me, that clearly seems to indicate that Stearns will go there. So Milwaukee might be a good trade partner also. They've got those two studs at the top of their rotation in Burns and Woodruff. And both of those guys are like a year plus away from free agency. And who's to say that they'll re-sign there? They're both younger than 30 right now. Yeah. Those would be great gets also, because I imagine that they're doing a little bit of a rebuild, at least a soft rebuild here.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you can't, you know, Willy Adames and Christian Yelich aren't going to carry it into the postseason, or at least you know, not expectedly. I think that they are solid pieces, but yeah, you have a Corbin Burns, who's a, you know, perennial Cy Young candidate. Brandon Woodruff, who is just a quintessential number two. That's a oh yeah. You know, I think Milwaukee can go either way there. I think that they can sell and sell high, or they can stick with them and add to it, because there's some man, you have to wonder if Keston Hiura turned out to be what everyone hoped he could be, what I still think he could be, but how that changes that franchise. And he's like not, I don't want to say he's an insignificant piece, but if he takes off, it's almost like the future set into place for that franchise.
Yeah, I think so.
Good stuff. I think we're all wrapped up, right? We're back next week.
Yeah.
All right. I think you guys know all the sign off. It's let's fucking go Mets. Let's hope we got some more news cooking over the week. And until then, Taryn, I think that's all we got, man.
Yeah. All right.
All right, guys. We will see you next time. Again, be sure to check out War on the Diamond. That's streaming everywhere on Tuesday the 15th, which also happens to be my eldest's 18th birthday, which blows my mind. Happy birthday, dear. I love you so much, more than anything in the world. And maybe we will reach out with some free streaming gift certificates for the War on the Diamond. I believe that Amazon is their spot, so maybe we'll have to throw some of those out there. But we will we'll take care of that on Tuesday. This will be out Monday, and we'll see you guys next time. Peace.